Welcome to This Week in the Warner Archive Collection, where we discuss our newest releases. I'm George Feltenstein, and I'm proud to be joined by my colleagues, Matt Patterson and D.W. Ferranti. 11 new additions to the Warner Archive Collection highlight this week's Warner Archive podcast. First and foremost, it's always a rousing moment for us when we have something that's new to Blue. And this is something that isn't new to the Warner Archive. It was part of the Warner Archive in our early days as a not very good looking DVD. But then we remastered it for DVD. And now we've remastered it again for Blu-ray in a brand new 2019 1080p master. It is the television pilot feature film that launched eventual TV movies and a series, which didn't last too long, but we've kept it alive underwater, which is no easy feat. It's Man from Atlantis, starring Patrick Duffy. This is the two-hour telefilm that introduced his character, aka Mark Harris. It looks absolutely spectacular on Blu-ray, and it is something we've been long excited to share with you, and that leads off our new releases, moving on to new releases on TV, on DVD, episodic sitcoms. We have a sad goodbye to a show that we've shepherded for 9 seasons, Alice. This is the 9th and final season of the Linda Lavin sitcom, which graced the airwaves in the 70s and 80s, and it's been our pleasure to bring to you. And the final episodes make up season 9, but Alice goes out with a smile, and we're delighted to be bringing it your way. And returning to the Warner Archive after many requests and our initial season 1 a few years ago, we have Hanging with Mr. Cooper, Season 2. This is from 1993 and 94, and this is a sitcom which a lot of people liked the fact that we released the first season. They wanted more. It took a couple of years, but here's Season 2 now available to you. And for classic film lovers, we have a plethora of classics that span from the 1920s to the 1950s, starting with A Woman of Affairs with the amazing legendary Greta Garbo, Star Witness, directed by one of my favorite directors, William Wellman. Night Court, starring Walter Huston. Snowed Under with the great Glenda Farrell. The King and the Chorus Girl with Fernand Gravet and
Joan Blondell.
I wanted you to say it. Broadway Musketeers with a wonderful group of Warner Brothers players. Twice Blessed with the amazing Wild Twins. And you'll find out how wild they get when we talk about this movie. And last but not least, Greer Garson and Robert Ryan star in the Ansco color epic Her 12 Men from 1954 in widescreen. So much to discuss, but let's go back underwater to the roots of the Warner Archive and Man from Atlantis, finally on Blu-ray.
So in this, our 10th year, and our celebrations of the 10th year, it's appropriate that we are releasing Man from Atlantis on Blu-ray, since Man from Atlantis in many ways was an integral part of both the early and the mids and now the mods of the Warner Archive. It's a film that has had a number of releases from the Warner Archive.
That's right. This telefilm was released initially, I think, in 2009?
That's correct.
By itself, and then it was then packaged in with the two other telefilms.
Wait. You went too fast.
When we went from the ugly blue template packaging,
which I remember,
Man from Atlantis, which was incorrectly titled The Man from Atlantis.
Totally different story.
In the ugly packaging.
Yes.
When we took our top releases and started giving them custom packaging, we repackaged Man from Atlantis.
Right.
But it was the same lousy, crappy, ugly 1-inch master on the disc. So a year or two later, when we started remastering things, we decided to remaster not just Man from Atlantis, the pilot feature film, but the other telefilms and the television series. And they looked great for DVD.
They did, and we took that to the Paley Center.
That's right.
We had a special event, which you can look up online, find clips, interviews with both Patrick Duffy and Belinda Montgomery, which was a lot of fun.
That
a little
was
intimidating for me because I tell you, my memories of this film are in my friend Kevin McCurley's basement, and we're watching it on our stomachs on his little color television.
In the Paley Center, we were watching the Blu-ray, and I remember thinking,
not
the Blu-ray.
Oh, I'm sorry. we were watching the DVD.
Yeah.
Sorry, I'm getting ahead of myself because I just couldn't imagine something like a Blu-ray because it looked better than it had ever looked before on DVD.
And now it looks spectacular.
And to clarify, when we remastered these films for DVD, the television shows and the films, the remastering was done using a high-definition source master,
right,
but without the amount of copious hours of color correction and, most important, dirt cleanup that,
yes,
is requisite within the Warner Archive. Anyway, it's requisite for Blu-ray release.
So after seeing that, when you pop in this Blu-ray and see it for the first time, much like the man from Atlantis himself and his weird glowing green eyes, I too could not believe what I was seeing.
The amount of detail in the ocean scenes,
yeah,
shot off the coast of Catalina while poor Mr. Duffy was nearly freezing to death, but you don't see it on screen.
No.
You can, people often talk about high definition, like, well, you can see the beard stubble. Well, you can see the little crenulations on the coral.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a lot of detail that they captured when they were shooting this that no one has been able to see till now.
What makes it even more unique is it's one of the rare forays into live-action filmmaking from Hanna-Barbera Productions.
It's not Hanna-Barbera-y. I mean, especially this.
Well, it's important to recognize the live-action arm of Hanna-Barbera that produced movies like Hard Case,
right,
which don't, or the
Gathering.
And the Bell Star,
right,
which aren't Hanna-Barbera-y. They actually had a pretty high quality. I mean, the guy who directed this, Lee Katzin, is a great, prodigious journeyman in TV, a good TV director. And, you know, we should mention Justman and Solo, who have certain things.
Sounds
in
like
their
a law firm.
So, you know, you've got two talents who worked on the original Star Trek, and this is sort of this live action arm going in a different direction. And you'll notice when you watch the show, they don't call out that this is coming from Hanna-Barbera.
No, and the tone on this is more adult than you'd expect from,
especially the first four telemovies.
Yeah.
I mean, when they show morphed into TV series, it went much more in a very Star Trek vein.
More for kids.
But the four TV movies are very sober, intelligent science fiction eco thrillers. Plus, you know, the bad guy is Victor Buono. You can't go wrong.
And it takes a while for him to appear in this. You have a very long and interesting sort of origin story, because Patrick Duffy literally washes up onto the beach.
Kind of like the Tempest. There's a
yeah,
storm and somebody washes up and he is both Ariel and Caliban.
Right, and his weakness, it turns out, in the hospital that they find out is that he is drying up and he needs to go back into the water. And that is his one weakness, is he needs to get back in the water after a while because he is an unexplained alien creature.
And because these movies and the series itself only ran a half season, it ran 13 episodes and then was canceled, and then Mr. Duffy went on to do Dallas for
thus
a decade or so,
dashing my dreams of a Man from Atlantis revival.
But
although Mr. Duffy himself did that revival in prose form, and you can find that book on Amazon.
And you can also find the interview I did with him when we released the TV movies and the series on DVD in the Warner Archive podcast archives on iTunes.
Scroll
and
back.
Various places that you find our podcast. That podcast was in 2011, I believe, that interview. He was a pleasure to speak with, and very supportive of our efforts, which at that time were nascent, and we're still here. And the fact that we're bringing it on Blu-ray is especially exciting. And if you are really hep with your Southern California locations, and you happen to be familiar with Culver City and MGM, you'll note that a lot of the surrounding outside locations are indeed in Culver City, because they use the facilities of MGM Television to make Man from Atlantis, even though it was not an MGM production.
And the water tank there, if I'm not mistaken, is
that's
that,
right.
Because that was one of the last water tanks that was still being, I think, the biggest at the time.
Well, I don't know if they used the underwater stage or the saucer tank. The saucer tank isn't there anymore, but it was still there in the 90s.
That's what I was thinking that it was, but I don't know either, but yeah. I was imagining, because it feels very big underwater, and the photography is actually quite wonderful.
Our next release, which is indeed another product of television, it is rare that we get to take a multi-season sitcom from season one all the way to its ending. Some of them we pick up halfway through because they started as regular retail releases. But Alice, starring Linda Lavin, had never been released on DVD. And we changed that early on in the early days of the Warner Archive with the release of season one. And then over the years, we've brought you season two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight, and now season nine. The finale, the last episodes of Alice, one of the really bellwether sitcoms for CBS in the late 70s and the early 80s, and you get to see a lot of polyester.
Oh, yeah.
You actually can watch the lapels get larger and smaller right. in the nine and seasons.
You
kind of
go from the Mr. Cotter era to the Family Ties era.
Right, you know? And then you watch...
they have clip shows in this season.
Yeah, and you're able to watch the shoulders get broader towards the 83s, 84s.
Well, sure, because it's Dynasty time. Yep. You know, but this is not a very long season. There are not as many episodes because the series clearly was ready to call it a day, and I think the creative people were ready to move on to other projects, but it was still popular. And of course, it was very popular in reruns, and Alice was one of those shows that actually had CBS Network reruns while it was still on the air at night. That's how popular it was.
It was an... continues to run, you know, kind of not as much, but it's on the retro channels.
Well, for a long time, place you could see it was on DVD from the Warner Archive. And in recent years, it has reappeared on the multiple proliferation of retro channels, as you call them, which carry stock and trade of classic television. But it's best to own it and have it on your shelf. Where you don't have to worry about commercials or buffering or anything else in the way of your... Or speed up, yes, or anything being cut.
Where you can also enjoy the nifty disc labels. Paul, our designer, who loves this show, he gave the artwork a little extra love on this, and you can tell through all nine seasons. Alice, unlike most TV shows, especially in the 70s, had the ability to have a true final episode.
It ends.
It ends. It wraps it up. They do a look back and a look forward. I mean, one of the things about the ending that I thought, give real credit to...
spoiler alert. Because
I hadn't watched this episode in 20, 30 years. You know, one of the great things about Alice were the diner regulars. And they used regular cast members, especially Marvin Kaplan, as regulars throughout all nine seasons. These guys sat at the counter and made jokes.
They were the chorus.
Were the chorus of the show. And in this final episode, they give each one of the diner regulars a little curtain call. It was very touching.
Mm-hmm. And you get montages, and you get what everybody gets what they want.
But it's sort of jarring when they're doing the Mel flashbacks.
Oh, those are funny.
Because it flashes back to early Mel, and by this time, Mel is just a giant teddy bear. Then it flashes back to Mean Mel.
Oh, Mean Mel.
Because Mel at the beginning was much more like the character was in the film Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore, which was not a comedy.
Right, but Tayback had too big a heart.
Yeah. We're very proud that we now have all nine seasons available on DVD, so order yours today. Another series from another era. It's really kind of weird to think that the last episode of Alice was only 8 years before the first episode of season two of Hanging with Mr. Cooper, because they feel like they're 30 years apart.
Yep.
But sitcoms had changed a lot, and Hanging with Mr. Cooper represented the kind of urban sitcoms that were very popular in the 90s that are really achieving and enjoying a renaissance today. And people were very, very happy that we started Hanging with Mr. Cooper on DVD a few years ago, and then very, very distressed that we didn't continue with the releases, but the hiccups have been eliminated, and now we continue forward with season two. And season two brings changes to Mr. Cooper.
Big changes. They hit the remix button. They're very happy with the chemistry between Mark Curry, who plays Mr. Cooper, and Holly Robinson-Pete as his roommate, Vanessa. They did a very TV thing, and they moved one character out and moved in the other character with the kid.
With the kid. sort of the same, but totally different.
Meets a kid.
And the kid is, of course, played by Raven Simone.
Yes.
So you can't really call it Cousin Oliver because she's there from second season on, and she becomes a very integral part of the show.
Well, she's so Raven.
Yeah, that's right.
That's what happened to her. She got her own show after this.
And then, of course, they also bring in Mark's new nemesis, his new boss, played by Nell Carter.
Which is a great move. And interestingly, Dan, you know, like the show Hanging with Mr. Cooper, you'd think it's a workplace comedy, right, about the school. It's kind of a blend between, you know, because it's got the roommate comedy.
And then, and it's very much a roommate family comedy. And then the that relationship extends into the school.
Yeah, where it plays out. And that's pretty unique to this show, I'd say. And
so for fans of the series, it's finally available season two with more to come. Now we move on to classic motion pictures on DVD that span the 20s, 30s, 40s, and 50s. So you've got, you know, a big chunk of cinema. And we start in the silent era with A Woman of Affairs starring Greta Garbo. And this is a special presentation that was part of a series of films that were lovingly brought to video in the 80s by the team of Kevin Brownlow and David Gill at Photoplay Productions. And new scores were written for these films that were available on VHS and Laserdisc. And only a few of them have been on DVD for a lot of technical and restoration reasons. But this one, A Woman from Affairs, is from that series and has an original score by the great Carl Davis. This is really an MGM classic at its finest, and is representative of the very, very end of the silent era, when silent movies were no longer what people perceive as creaky, and, you know, the film speed had been locked in, the cameras were electric, and the way the films were directed were, silent film had really reached an apex that was undone by the coming of sound.
It's almost like this film in my head has dialogue.
That is what I was just about to say.
Because it feels more 1932-ish.
When you look like back on this film,
how fluid it is.
You do not recall title cards. You recall character and action and relations. And it very much plays as if it's a sound film, which it isn't. It's Garbo and Gilbert at their sizzlingest.
Superstars.
Reunited after Flesh and the Devil, and when they were having a real life affair and were planning to be married.
And the film has a number of, I mean, I won't call it pre-code,
it's
but pre-code-ish.
Oh, yeah.
That's why it feels 32.
There's a lot of subtext you have to read into the film to see what's going on. I mean, they're not hiding it, but they're not calling it out either. They're just letting the sophisticated people go, oh, that must be why she's in the hospital.
It has this sort of high gloss, you know, high but low feel that, and again, like, you know, because we've talked about, especially John Gilbert before in the transition to the talkies, this is a good movie to see that isn't maybe as widely seen, where you really get to see the stars shine.
And you also get to see John Mac Brown, unlike John Mac Brown.
That's right.
It is star-studded.
It really is. And it's a true bona fide classic. And we're delighted to bring it to DVD. To go from the glamour of MGM to the ripped from the headline stories of Warner Brothers in 1931, our next film is directed by the great William Wellman. And this is The Star Witness from 1931. And truly,
truly ripped,
was
from,
ripped from the headlines. Yes. And Dan, do you want to let people in on what the real life adventures in New York
that inspired this story?
A
rather scandalous event occurred in New York at the time where school children were killed in a mob activity, and the police could not get any witnesses to come forward because they were afraid of reprisal. So long before there was Charlestown in Massachusetts and the code of silence there was a code of silence gripping New York, and it was very scandalous because people wouldn't even come forward on behalf of children. Bill Wellman, in this film, he gives you what, three films in one?
And a running time that is the equivalent to a short subject at MGM.
Yeah, and he shifts genres seamlessly, like that you start off and it's a quirky family drama about, you know, it's a pre-Monsieur Hulot. And there's a zany grandpa coming to visit, and he's a Civil War vet who's still kind of living in the war, and the kids love him, and the and the parents kind of tolerate them.
It's like you've seen this movie before, and then it Game of Thrones you.
Yeah, and then there's a crime, and the family's involved, and then there's a courtroom drama, and then there's a suspense kidnap thriller with some really brutal violence.
The mob is believably brutal in this, and you can feel what a problem society was facing at this time.
And only Warner Brothers would make a movie like this.
Yeah, and you know, the two stars, the grandpa character is played by Chick Sale, who could play very old when he was very young, and then the
he did.
Yeah, and the crusading district attorney, who probably in real life was like 3 years separate,
yeah,
but
right,
is like 40 years younger in this film, is Walter Huston.
And speaking of Walter Huston, he's in our next film, which does come from MGM from 1932.
And in this film, there are two judges, one played by Walter Huston, the other played by Lewis Stone. So that immediately tells you, in this go-around, Huston ain't the good guy.
Not at all. It is called Night Court, and it has nothing to do with
the sitcom. I was
going to
say, this is one of our kind of famous for bringing Night Court to DVD, but there ain't no Harry Anderson around here. This is a really terrific movie, and Lewis Stone does his best non-Judge Hardy judge in this film, but it's captivating, much in the way Star Witness is captivating, yep, but with a different sensibility, a different style. And it shows the greatness of Walter Huston as an actor, and the wonderful performances that he would give in movies like Gabriel Over the White House and so many others. He did a lot of wonderful work long before he became an Oscar winner.
And this is kind of a scenario that could be a modern-day thriller.
This would still work today, and especially since, you know, its nightmare scenario is how easily a corrupt judge in a corrupt system can railroad an innocent person.
Nothing like that happens today.
But
no.
Sort of from the point of view of a husband, he goes away to work, and when he comes home, his wife is gone. And
his domestic reality has been completely upended.
Yeah, and his baby.
Yeah.
They're gone, and he doesn't know, and no one will tell him. But they have been kind of swept up in
collateral damage in a war between a good judge and a bad judge.
Yeah.
And the thing that I love about this film is that once you realize this movie is 86 years old, the plot points, the centrifuge of it is timeless in the emotion that it can evoke from the viewer. It's a really, really powerful film.
I mean, that's why you really could just update this, because it has that existential dread.
Well, on a much lighter note, we bring you our next film, which is from 1936. It's a Warner Brothers film with a cast filled with delightful people, and it's Snowed Under.
And it is, I'm going to call this one of the unrecognized screwball canons, because it's 36.
Okay.
But it's got Connecticut.
Yes.
It's got a weather event.
Yes.
It's not just one remarriage comedy.
No.
It's a three remarriage comedy.
One inside the other.
And it has one of my favorite MacGuffins, because it's a film about finishing a drama.
Of course.
So George Brent stars as a guy. He's a Broadway wunderkind, and he's been married and divorced twice, and he's being chased by a young collegiate girl, and his play is unfinished. And the play's producer becomes concerned that he's not going to finish the play. So he dispatches first wife.
Wife one.
Sensible wife one, played by Genevieve Tobin, to help him finish the play. And while she's there, people get snowed under. And then
wife two.
Wife two, played by Glenda Farrell, who's terrific in this film.
And who we tend to talk about a lot. She's like the female Alan Jenkins of the Warner Archive podcast.
Yeah.
And here, she is terrible wife, too.
She's hilarious. And then, of course, there's the young girl that believes...
Betrothed?
Yeah. She believes that they're going to be married.
And happy, and that the other women are just old.
This is the kind of film that no one talks about.
Nope.
No one knows. And it deserves to be reappraised for its true entertainment value. And that is the essence of the mission statement of the Warner Archive
Collection. I mean, the film has Frank McHugh playing an ex-milkman turned marshal.
But Alan Jenkins is not in it.
I know. I just
and
figured.
You still liked
you
it.
Still, yeah, I just figured Alan was, you know, busy with the producer and his part got cut.
Right.
Frank, he was probably working two sound stages away.
Yeah. Frank did a wonderful job.
It's either Alan Jenkins or Frank McHugh.
I'm going to suggest you watch this movie with a jug of Applejack and drink it every time the characters do.
This is one of the few movies that Applejack plays an important plot device. and as well as Stage Snow.
It would make a great double feature with Captain Applejack, another one of our releases.
Our other Applejack movie.
Our next film is from 1937 and stars one of the leading lights of the leading ladies at Warner Brothers, one of our favorites, Joan Blondell, who stars with a relative newcomer to the screen, Fernand Gravé, in The King and the Chorus Girl. This is from 1937 and is very, very much familiar in its plot settings, but very, very distinctive nonetheless.
Now, one of the film's two screenwriters is Norman Krasna, and this is very much a Krasna fairy tale film with high and low intermixing for romantic comedy. But the other screenwriter adds the film
zest.
Some real, real lemon zest in the dialogue, and that is Norman Krasna's friend Groucho Marx. And this film has a number of, as only Groucho could write, hilarious double entendres and zingers.
And Groucho wasn't exactly known for being a screenwriter of movies that had nothing to do with the Marx Brothers.
I'm watching it going, God, you know what all these Lifetime movies need, you know, the...
They need Groucho.
They need Groucho. They need the Groucho filter.
Because they have humor, but I'm always like, oh, this just needs to be a little sharper. And this is what you wish all these Lifetime movies was like.
Now, Fernand Gravé, the following year, would star to great acclaim as Johann Strauss in The Great Waltz, which is another Warner Archive DVD, one of our bestsellers, as a matter of fact. But this was Fernand Gravé before that, and this is another one of those films that never really gets discussed much. And Joan Blondell had already done her gold digging several times, and this gives her a chance to shine without Glenda Farrell on her arm. And the two of them are terrific together, and it's really unique to have that combination of Norman Krasna and Groucho writing the screenplay. It's quite unique. Now, our next film features a bevy of Warner Brothers favorites as they become Broadway Musketeers, and this was made here at Warner Brothers in 1938.
Now, if the plot seems slightly familiar to you pre-code fans,
it's because
it is a remake of Three on a Match, but it's a true,
it stands on its own.
It takes plot elements from Three on a Match and moves them over into a whole different setting and play.
What's interesting is I didn't know that when I popped it in. I'm looking at the cover art before I put it in and I go, oh, this will be a pleasant comedy. And it starts out like one.
It's light and then it gets dark.
And then it gets dark and I'm like crying at the end.
And of course, Three in a Match was pre-code. This is not. So but they had to eliminate certain
things. Yes.
They did, but it...
But it feels pre-code.
It's still
on the streets.
Well, and they were very much able to take a good story and remake it several times. Probably more than any other studio.
And the three in this case are Margaret Lindsay, Marie Wilson, and Ann Sheridan. They're all great, but, you know, Margaret Lindsay, because she gets to traverse the most terrain, is really great in this.
This is grand entertainment and very, very interesting if you've only seen Three on a Match.
Yeah.
And if you haven't, we recommend you pick up our Forbidden Hollywood collection that contains it. But that early 30s film is taken into a late 30s scenario here to great success, I think. Our next film comes from 1945 and comes from across the hill back to MGM land, and this is Twice Blessed, and it stars the Wild Twins, and these were real-life twins who passed away not so long ago, and they never really achieved screen stardom. They had little parts in a couple of MGM pictures, and this was an attempt by MGM to give them their own vehicle to see if they could carry a film on their own.
My dad is an identical twin, and so I have a special appreciation for mixed up twin identity films.
So did your dad like trade identities with his genius brother?
No, that's what was interesting is that these two twins were almost like night and day.
This is a nature versus nurture
film. It's kind of like Patty and Kathy.
Yeah.
On the Patty Duke show. They were cousins.
Right.
They were identical cousins.
No, but the whole time I'm watching this film in the back of my head, I'm like, they're cousins. Identical cousins. So they're two sisters, but thanks to a divorce when they're early on, one is raised by the behaviorist mother.
Who is a professional woman.
Jet set intellectual. and she's basically raising the child like B.F. Skinner. Yes. And then the husband, who's a gruff, warm-hearted newspaper man, is letting his daughter be raised like a normal Riverdale-style American sock-hopping teenager.
Almost like a little from the future. So, like, she was like a teen from the 50s and 45.
One daughter is national genius, and the other daughter is training for a dance competition with Marshall Thompson.
But not unlike a film that would follow 16 years later, The Parent Trap.
Yep.
Yes, I mean, that's what this is.
Parent Trap was based on a European novel, so there's just coincidence but similarities in the plot.
You gotta bring mom and dad.
Kind of like, wow.
No, it's very similar.
So the young girls decide to swap roles. For fun. And as they swap roles, they decide, you know, maybe they should get mom and dad back together.
Our last of these new-to-DVD classics is Her 12 Men, with the lovely Greer Garson showing off her beautiful, unmistakable hair in glamorous Ansco color, which was a short-lived color process. But this film was also in widescreen. And Her 12 Men has a very specific reference in the title.
She is a young widower, and she's basically been a housewife.
She's forced into the working world.
And thanks to the connections of society, she's given a job at a private boarding school for boys.
So, however,
her 12 men are her 12 charges.
But there have been no women who worked there before, so they keep calling her sir.
And the gentleman who is in charge of the young kids at the school, she is hired over his objections. And, you know, when that person is Robert Ryan, you're going to have some trouble. Now, what's interesting in this is Robert Ryan's great in this, but Robert Ryan is playing a very
Robert Ryan part.
If you ever wondered what he was like in real life, this is actually more like him than any of his film roles.
Robert Ryan's character as a man who works in a boys' boarding school, he has a great extracurricular life with his convertible.
He's like a playboy private school teacher. It's kind of crazy. But he's also a strong proponent for progressive education. And the film has some very sort of 1950s logic, because it's like, oh, so you decided to lie to the children. Excellent.
Yeah, that's what you're supposed to do.
James Arness has a part that, frankly, I wish was a little bigger. Mm. He plays sort of a goofy phys ed teacher, and he's great. And then, of course, Barry Sullivan shows up as the Texas love interest.
You got to have a choice between the rich man and the earnest
We've
man.
We've discussed a lot of our favorite performers who have been in so many of our films, and Robert Ryan is our kind of like number two guy when we're talking about film noir.
Yeah.
But here you see someone who's totally the opposite of film noir Robert Ryan. This is almost like Carl Betts Robert Ryan.
Yeah. Right.
You know? It's very bizarre. But this is really a delightful film.
I see it as like, you know, it's Harry Potter without the magic.
And it was after this film, if I'm doing my math correctly, but I believe that after 15 years at MGM, Greer Garson parted company.
This was her last
film. The studio after this, and then headed to this place called Warner Brothers to make Strange Lady in Town, which is also available from the Warner Archive.
For us, an uncontinued streak.
So, hey, she made a lot of, she did Sunrise at Campobello. She kept working, you know. She was one of the favorites of L.B. Mayer, and I think that, like a lot of people that were under contract to the studio, this is when the contracts were running out and the contract system was being eliminated at all studios as the forces of television and not owning theaters were changing the Hollywood dynamic.
Yeah.
Yes, Hollywood has been through trajectories of change before, and the mid-50s was certainly one of those periods, but Greer Garson at MGM had a 15-year run, and she would return to play the Mother Superior in The Singing Nun in 1966, and you have to think that L.B. Mayer is smiling down upon that one. But Her 12 Men stands on its own as a delightful and insightful film, and we're delighted to finally be bringing it to DVD.
Well, you know what? It's coming up very soon. The Warner Archive birthday.
That's right. in only a few weeks, the Warner Archive is going to celebrate its 10th birthday and begin its 11th year of bringing you the finest in motion picture and television entertainment, as well as animation.
But I'm not getting into the cake.
No, not yet, because the cake has yet to be baked. But we thought that we would talk a little bit, since we were talking about Alice and Man from Atlantis, of all the different TV that we have been able to bring your way over the years and continue to. With Man from Atlantis, I almost said the. With Man from Atlantis on Blu-ray being kind of a milestone in a continued progression of betterment, we look back at so many of the series that we did in completion to DVD. I think of 9 seasons of Alice. I think of 9 seasons of the FBI.
Wow, yeah, that's a lot of episodes.
Hour-long dramas, that's a lot of episodes.
That's a lot of guest stars.
That's right. 5 seasons of Dr. Kildare and 7 seasons of Cheyenne.
And 7 seasons of Medical Center.
That's right.
1 season of Nichols.
Lots of great one-season shows.
I just had to plug that one.
One season of the Dakotas, because it was only a half season and it was 19 episodes.
I also
think of a sitcom like Hank, which ran on NBC for 1 season and then wasn't seen again for 50 years until we remastered it and made it available. And we've done that many, many times. And of course, Man from Atlantis is a pilot telefilm. Telefilms are a core part of our business, and we've brought you so many of them, and now we're starting to bring them out on Blu-ray, which is particularly exciting. Last Halloween was made all the more brighter with the arrival of Bad Ronald. We hope to be bringing you more television movies and even miniseries in the future on Blu-ray, because Blu-ray is really the focal point of our most fervent efforts, and yet we don't want to deny any part of the catalog, and we have such a broad base of fandom that we're trying to be all things to all people, which is very, very difficult.
There's a difference between, let's say, like people who like classic sitcoms like Courtship of Eddie's Father and something like Family Matters, which we also just recently completed.
Right. And that's just on the TV side.
Yeah.
Can no one mention Search?
No.
I was going to.
No okay. one is allowed. Good.
I just want to say,
and then
on the sort of hybrid side, Shazam.
Oh yeah,
which is Saturday morning, but is live action. Now, if you're just joining us, Search is, of course, the show that was way ahead of its time with a rotating series of leads, special operatives hired by World Securities Corporation, and they use various miniature surveillance devices to accomplish their missions with the aid of a full mission control room of experts. And if you've ever seen 24, they saw Search.
And there was a pilot telefilm for that called Probe.
Mm-hmm.
And the series couldn't be called Probe because PBS had a series at the time with that title, so they changed the name of the show to Search.
To something unsearchable.
But if you search,
yes.
If you search to find Search anywhere else on television or other means of viewing, you won't find it, because the only way you can see it is by getting the DVD from the Warner Archive Collection.
Dan, how long have you been on the Yahoo mailing list fan service for Search?
The Search Yahoo listserv?
Your listserv.
97?
Since 1997. And then probably a personal great achievement was bringing this out to DVD.
Oh, huge bucket list.
To tell the listserv.
Because I think we had already released Probe before you came and worked here. Yeah.
You had one of our first conversations. It was like, hey, have you heard of this so-called Search? And you were like, on it.
But it was very expensive to make it happen, and it took a long time to convince people that it was worth doing. And then, of course, you have things like The Lieutenant, bringing people where Gene Roddenberry's mind was right before he went to Star Trek.
You know, as part of the 10th anniversary, I've been publishing sort of like daily flashbacks to early releases, and I've sort of been alternating between film and TV, and recently, like last week, I posted a clip from The Lieutenant on our Facebook page. That's Facebook.com/Warner Archive. And I posted a clip with Leonard Nimoy and Majel Barrett. And tons of people were responding to it because they had no idea what it was. They had no idea what The Lieutenant was. right? And people were like starting to connect the dots, and they were like, yes, this is what led to Nimoy being on Star Trek. And they were like, oh, I got to show this to my friend.
The whole series is incredible because it's like you mix that with Navy movies,
mm-hmm.
and you have Star Trek.
And that also reminds me of the failed Roddenberry pilots that we brought up.
Oh, right, Planet Earth, gosh, Genesis 2. Yeah.
Right.
Yes.
And post then the other one that he had nothing to do with but was still based on the same Pax story, Strange New Worlds.
Right.
All those things.
Yeah.
We continued to go on that trajectory, and we will continue to release more TV movies and hopefully bring you more TV movies and miniseries on Blu-ray, some of which we'd brought out before. The options are really mind-boggling, and we just want to make sure that we've covered all the bases. And if your favorites are not among what we're bringing out and you want to know more about what we have in store, you can send us a letter.
Oh,
and
yes.
We read them on the air. As a matter of fact, we've got one today. And Matt, if people want to send us correspondence, where should they send it?
To Warner Archive Podcast, 3400 Riverside Drive, B160-4, Burbank, California, 91522. And if you send us a self-addressed stamped envelope, Dan may put something inside of it and send it back to you.
You might get some, as Bogart used to call it, swag.
Now, I open these live on the air, and as you can hear, this is...
We have no idea what's inside.
Large manila envelope.
It could be a lollipop.
And this is from Bill from Manchester, Maryland. And and he sent a very large self-addressed stamped envelope.
Good for Bill.
And
thank
a handwritten
you,
note.
Not in crayon, but still love it.
Where he says, on this little post-it, he's like, providing the self-addressed stamped envelope, like you said. Hello, gents. Let me begin by introducing myself and telling you I'm a longtime listener who enjoys film and television, but primarily listens because of the banter between the three of you. Your friendship and the love of the subject matter is conveyed in every episode. Warner Archive is blessed to have spokesmen with both humor and knowledge. Are you aware of any releases starring Ralph Bellamy? I am particularly fond of him in Parole Girl of 1933 and Guest in the House of 1944. These films were not originally released by Warner Brothers, but perhaps the rights have been obtained? If you don't mind, perhaps you can explain how Warner has obtained rights to titles not originally produced at the studio. I look forward to possibly hearing your response in a future podcast, and I'm closing to convey my appreciation to all involved with Warner's restoration efforts. Respectfully, Bill.
Well, thank you, Bill. And both of those Ralph Bellamy films you mentioned are not part of our library. But I will very succinctly try to summarize how the Warner Brothers Entertainment Library grew to be the industry's largest. And even with the upcoming merger of two mega studios, they still won't have as many films as us.
Yes, so take that, mouse.
That's right. So we, of course, have all the Warner Brothers films. And we also... by virtue of Warner Brothers' acquisition of Turner Entertainment when Turner Broadcasting was purchased by Time Warner in 1996. All pre-1986 MGM movies came our way, as well as what was left of the RKO library came our way. And I say what was left was RKO was a studio that sold off a lot of films for remake purposes to other studios, or maybe they only distributed, but the core main RKO library, the Fred and Ginger movies, Citizen Kane, so forth and so on, that's part of what we own as well. Add to that that Warner Brothers bought Lorimar in the late 80s, and Lorimar was primarily a television company that had made some theatrical features, but Lorimar also bought Allied Artists, which was a motion picture studio that made primarily B films, sometimes an A movie here and there, but Allied Artists went into bankruptcy in 1979 and was acquired by Lorimar. So when Warner Brothers bought Lorimar, we also ended up with Lorimar's Allied Artist Library, which also contains the part of the Monogram Library. And I say part because Monogram had sold off a bunch of films to other people. So not every Monogram film is owned by us, but Monogram, Allied Artists, Lorimar, that comes with part of the territory. Then add to the Turner acquisition, New Line Cinema, Castle Rock Productions, and for you Animaniacs out there, Hanna-Barbera Productions and Ruby Spears Productions. So you put all that in a blender and plus, press shake.
Yeah, but plus wait, the miscellaneous spices.
What about National General and Brute?
Well, thank you, thank you. Brute Productions, which was just a very short group of films, was acquired by Turner Broadcasting before Turner Broadcasting acquired the MGM library. So that's in there.
Seven
and
Arts.
Warner Brothers. Now you see, this is I was trying to keep it succinct.
We're just sort of
Seven
joking.
Arts was an independent production company that actually bought out Jack Warner's stock and created Warner Brothers Seven Arts. And then the Seven Arts guys left 2 years later and the company became Warner Brothers again, but the Seven Arts Library, if the rights weren't sold off elsewhere, also became part of our library. And National General was an independent company that was a spinoff of National Theaters, and they weren't having a good time making it. So Warner Brothers obtained partial control of its assets and eventually all control of its assets, I think by the late 70s or early 80s, even though the first transaction began in the 70s. And then there are all sorts of side situations where a certain group of films that are independently owned, we have certain rights. For example, we have domestic home video rights to the films produced by the late Samuel Goldwyn Sr., and that is through the Samuel Goldwyn Jr. Family Trust. We have those films under license for domestic home entertainment, but we don't own them and we license them. And there are various other deals like that, which will end up with a film coming our way. Then you'll see a film which was made by an independent producer and somehow ended up with Warner Brothers. There was a producer who made several films that were released by 20th Century Fox in the early 50s, including The Star and The Fireball, and that became part of the Warner Brothers library. Or a 1946 Universal release like So Goes My Love, which reverted to its producer, who ended up selling it to Warner Brothers. And then there are all the movies that were purchased for remake.
Yeah.
MGM bought Showboat from Universal, the 1929-36 versions, to remake it in 1951. So all the Showboats are with us. So we actually have films from Universal, from Paramount, from 20th Century Fox as original distributors. But basically, the core libraries are the Warner Brothers Library, the pre-86 MGM Library, the RKO Library, New Line, Lorimar, Allied Artists, Monogram, Castle Rock, etc., Hanna-Barbera. It's a lot of entertainment and a lot of wonderful cinema and television that spans over a century that it is our great honor to be the custodians of. So hopefully that was as succinct and brief as possible.
That was good.
Yeah, it's comprehensive. And that's why Warner Archive is so large.
That's right, with over 3,500 releases.
It really is.
And hey, we're only 10 years old. We've got a long way to go.
No other studio could do this.
That's right, and no other studio has, although many have tried. But we persevere, and we also are grateful for our opportunities to work with many creative people in the community who support our efforts and the archives around the world who work with us. So many people work with us to make our work possible, especially the wizards of ours at Warner Brothers Motion Picture Imaging, who do our mastering and restoration, and they are absolutely magicians at what they do. So we've got a lot of exciting things in store as we begin the next generation. Meanwhile, it's time to wrap up this Warner Archive podcast, and until next time, I'm George Feltenstein.
I'm Matt Patterson.
I'm Mark Harris.
You know, those yellow trunks look great on you. You should keep it up. Thanks for listening, and look forward to the next Warner Archive podcast.